Thanks very much for this invitation. I'm very happy to be able to give this talk, and so thanks for joining us. And yeah, so the talk is about discrete holography, and I'm going to explain right away first what I mean by this. In case you wonder about the picture, so Würzburg is a city in the north of Bavaria, and it has several beautiful castles, one of which is this one, which is over the river Main, so just to advertise the place. And okay, let's hop right in. And so what I want to tell you about is to establish a holographic duality very similar to the ADS-CFT correspondence, but not on a continuous space, but rather on a discretized version where we look at regular polygons of this type. And so you can see, because the ones in the middle are big and the ones at the border are small, that this is a projection of a hyperbolic negatively curved space onto the plane. And so just to guide you through the talk, so these are the points that I'm going to talk about. I motivate why we want to do this. And that includes a brief review of the origins of the ADS-CFT correspondence, because a lot of the motivation is going to be that we want to be as precise as the original ADS-CFT proposal, but now in the context of these discretized lattices. This is a hyperbolic tiling, so I'm going to then describe to you some facts about these hyperbolic tilings. And one application example that we're going to look at is the so-called Breiten-Lohner-Friedmann bound, which is one of the foundations of the ADS-CFT correspondence. And so it's interesting to see how this is realized in this discretized setting. Then we will move on to the heart of the matter, which is the duality should be a relation between some dynamical theory in the bulk and some dynamical theory at the boundary, which means that we have to establish a particular Hamiltonian on the boundary that describes is related to the physics of the bulk. And so we have actually a proposal of how to do this. And so the important point is that this it will be a spin train Hamiltonian, but which will reflect the properties of the bulk tiling. So that's one of the main messages I'm going to show. And then we will study some of the properties of this Hamiltonian using RG techniques and also tensor networks. And to check some of the suggestions that we have, we are going to use entanglement entropy. And so then finally, the last four slides, I think what is extremely interesting about this topic is that it really relates to many different branches of physics. So here I'm coming from quantum field theory, the ADS-CFT correspondence, but so there's some very interesting work in pure mathematics, very recently now also in condensed matter theory, even experiment in the context of some realization of ideas in electric circuits. And of course, there's also a relation to quantum gravity using approaches where there's discretization is used to make statements about quantum gravity. And so I think this is very beautiful about this topic, that it relates to so many other fields. And I think a lot of more progress can be made on top of what I'm going to show today by using ingredients from all of these things and bringing them together. And so that's one of the fun aspects of this topic. And so I conclude with an outlook, because of course I outlined a very nice program to you, but of course we are not even halfway there. I mean, we made some initial steps, but many things still need to be done. And so I'm going to show how we expect to make progress and what the goals are going to be. By the way, if you would like to ask questions during the talk, please do. I think there's this microphone which can be tossed around, and that would be very helpful. So please feel free to ask questions during the talk. Okay, let me start the introduction part or review part, motivation part, by just giving my definition of the word duality, and which applies to the ADS-CFT correspondence, but we also want for these discrete settings. So my definition of duality is in this picture here. So consider that you have the following scenario. You have some physical system, your preferred object of study, be it experimental or theoretical. And then you actually realize that you find two different theories. So a theory in physics means that if you're a particle physicist or a relativist, that you have an action. Condensed matter physicists have Hamiltonians. And you realize that you have physical theories given either by an action or a Hamiltonian. And there will be two of them. Okay, so one of them will be written in some particular degrees of freedom, and the other one will be written in terms of other types of degrees of freedom. But you realize that both these theories actually describe the physical system that you are interested in. Then obviously there must be a relation between these two theories, and this relation we are going to call a duality. So that makes a very general physics-oriented definition of this word, which of course has many different meanings in maths and physics. But that's what I'm, if I say duality during the talk, this is actually what we mean, okay? This is actually quite common in quantum field theory, especially in 1+1 dimensions. There's dualities between fermionic and bosonic quantum field theories, like the Sein-Gordon massive Thiering duality, which is also a boson-fermion duality in 1+1 dimensions. And those are extremely well understood, and you can really map the degrees of freedom of one system to the other, and vice versa. Now, the ADS-CFT correspondence, which now will be around for 25 years in November, has a very special property because it's the first duality between a theory that involves gravity, so a gravity theory, and a quantum field theory that does not involve gravity. Okay, so, and that makes this duality very special among all the dualities that they are in physics. And okay, so you might wonder if this has any implications for what gravity is, but that's not what we're going to talk about today. So, but nevertheless, I think this fact is very, very important. All right, so now you can go further. And so the ADS-CFT correspondence involves an anti-de Sitter space in the conformal field theory. So there's a huge amount of symmetries involved. But it has turned out that this principle can actually be generalized to scenarios with less of these global symmetries. And that brings us to this concept of gauge gravity duality, where on one hand side you have a gauge quantum field theory, and on the other side a gravity theory. And so I gave you this definition of the word duality, but actually there's also other meanings of the word duality that come into play. And in particular, in a given limit that I'm going to introduce very soon, there's a map between a quantum field theory at strong coupling and a theory of gravitation at weak coupling. So there's also this element of a strong weak coupling duality involved here. I will come back to this shortly. And another very important point is this aspect of holography and the holographic principle. So because the quantum field theory is in d dimensions, whereas the gravitational theory is in d+1 dimensions, there may even be more other dimensions, internal dimensions, which I will also talk about. But the important point is that the quantum field theory will be defined at the boundary of this d+1 dimensional space. So this, these hyperbolic spaces, they have a boundary, and which is then obviously in one dimension less, and that's where you define this quantum field theory. Okay, so what is very important for what I want to do in this talk is that the original form of the duality, as due to Malassina, actually originates from string theory. And so what Malassina, so how he arrived at the proposal was to consider so-called D-brains within string theory. And so just very briefly, string theory, supersymmetric string theory is well defined in 10 dimensions. And these three brains, where D stands for Dirichlet boundary condition, and three refers to the fact that we consider three space and one time dimension, so 3+1 dimensions in this example, then actually have, they can be viewed in two different ways. And so it's exactly a duality in the sense I introduced at the beginning, meaning that our physical system will now be these D3 brains. And you can describe them either in theory one or theory two. And in fact, theory one in this case is an open string theory, where these D3 brains provide first surfaces where these strings can end, whereas theory two will be a gravity theory. And in fact, closed strings are the massless excitations of gravitons. And so this here, the brains will actually be solitonic solutions of the supergravity equations of motion. And now there's a very particular interesting low energy limit where you only consider the massless degrees of freedom, where actually in the so-called near horizon geometry, which actually corresponds to these very low energetic degrees of freedom, because these brains are very massive, they curve the space around them and you get a particular geometry which is precisely a five-dimensional anti-de-Sitter space. And because you have to make up for the 10 dimensions, there will be also an S5 here, okay, a five-dimensional sphere. Okay, and then, so this means in a particular low energy limit, in the open string part of the duality, you get a supersymmetric, actually n x to 4 super Young Mills theory, so a supersymmetric SU-n gauge theory in four dimensions, where the large n limit will play an important role. And on the other hand, you get supergravity on the space ADS 5 times S5. And so then if the duality holds at this level, it should also hold at that level. All right, so there are further very important limits which we can take in the ADS-CFT correspondence. And I want to mention them here because later when we talk about this, the discrete trace, we have to ask ourselves where these limits are in this new setting. So the strongest form of the ADS-CFT correspondence is that the statement that SUN super Young Mills theory should be dual to type 2B string theory on ADS 5 times S5. For any n and for any lambda. Okay, so for any n is the rank of the gauge group and lambda is the Tuft coupling, which I have defined for you here with G, the Young-Mills coupling. And so the first limit that one usually takes, so this is a duality between two quantum theories. However, this theory is rather unwieldy and it's not really clear how to do explicit calculation in this theory. But in the limit when n goes to infinity, you can show that the string coupling, which actually is given by the Young-Mills coupling squared, well, just by some simple algebra rearranging this formula, you see that this is lambda over n. So if we take the so-called Tuft lambda, limit and keep lambda fixed and send n to infinity, then the string coupling goes to zero, which means that your quantum string theory becomes a classical string theory, okay, which is under much better control. Then, so you arrive at this intermediate stage of the duality. And then there's a further limit which you can take, and this corresponds of also taking the Tuft coupling to be very large. And because there's a fundamental relation in string theory which tells you that this will be the ADS radius divided by the string length to the fourth power. So if you take this to infinity, then this means that in units of the ADS scale, the string length goes to zero, and this means you go to point-like particles. Okay, so in the second step, you go to type 2B supergravity, which means a theory of point-like particles. Okay, and so this duality is very nice because here calculations are rather straightforward. You just have to solve the equations of motion of a classical gravity theory, so the Euler-Lagrange equations, and this will then provide you predictions for a quantum field theory at strong coupling, okay? Okay, another, so I'm repeating all these things because we want to redo all of this in the discrete case in the next few slides, but let me just mention a few further important steps. So in the case of the ADS-CFT correspondence, there are lots of global symmetries and they're really decisive in making this whole thing work. And so in this D3 brain example that I just showed to you, the bosonic global symmetries of both, so SUN is local, this is a gauge symmetry, okay, so there's a global symmetry trees of both this super Young-Mills theory and of ADS 5 times S5 are SO4,2, which is the conformal group, and SU4, which is the R symmetry of the quantum field theory. But on the other side, these are the isometries of ADS 5, and SU4 is isomorphic to SO6, and SO6 are the symmetries of this five-dimensional sphere. So on that side, you have a geometrical realization of the symmetries. Here for the sphere and the, this actually ADS 5 has the same symmetries as a conformal field theory in one dimension less. Okay, and so it's really important for this duality that these symmetries match on the two sides. Now another further important thing that we need for duality in the sense that I'm describing is that we have to solve the equations of motion of supergravity, and we need to impose particular boundary conditions. And so if you solve, for instance, the equation of motion for a scalar field in anti-de Sitter space, then there's a leading and a subleading term. So just solving the differential equation, so if z is the coordinate which is perpendicular to the boundary, so which goes into your holographic directions, then the leading term is z to the power d minus delta, where d is the space-time dimension of the boundary theory, so 4 in the case of SU4 super-Young-Mills theory. And delta is the dimension of an operator which is dual to this particular field, okay? So, and the subleading term has the expectation, so the subleading term goes with z to the power delta, and the subleading term has precisely the expectation value of this operator as coefficient. Okay, so this is really a duality in the sense that the first two terms are on the boundary and the z factors are in the bulk, okay? And so this can be interpreted as a source in the sense of quantum field theory for the operator, and that's the expectation value of this operator. And that's very important. And then furthermore, if you expand your 10-dimensional scalar field in spherical harmonics on this S5, then you get a mass in the Klein-Gordon equation for your scalar field, and the mass of this field is related to the scaling dimension of the dual operator, and we have this very important relation here, all right? So that's very crucial and will appear now when we move to the discrete case. So now let me give you some motivation why do we want to look at the discrete case, and I think if you asked me, say, 15 years ago, if we can have such a duality outside string theory, I would have said no, because what I just showed you was that there's this very strong string theory motivation for the correspondence. However, in the last couple of years, starting with this famous paper by Riho and Takayanagi, there has been a lot of relations between quantum information on the one hand side and gravity via the ADS-CFT correspondence on the other side. And in particular, as was proposed in this paper, the leading term in the entanglement entropy of the field theory is given by an area of minimal surface in the holographic dimension. So which you can see here. So if you have, this is one spatial region and its complement, and you calculate the entanglement entropy, then two leading orders will be given by this surface. And that's a very nice example where even it's not really clear if you need string theory here. It's a relation of mapping quantum information theoretic object in the field theory to a geometric object in the gravity side. And so there's many more examples where these things happen and which have been studied in the last couple of years. So I think it's a very valid question to ask if we can establish dualities beyond string theory, because then I think we will learn much more about the working mechanisms of ADS-CFT itself. I mean, remember that ADS-CFT is still a conjecture. I mean, there's no mathematical proof of what I've told you so far. Okay, so what we are aiming at are examples for field theory, gravity theory dualities beyond string theory. And so the motivation is this relation between entanglement and geometry. This is related to this Takayanagi expression, but already, even before, it's already encoded in this holographic principle. So n is the rank of the gauge group, which counts your degrees of freedom at the boundary. And this is actually on the gravity side given. So these are gravity quantities, but you can actually show that the number of degrees of freedom of the boundary of your ADS space, which is four-dimensional, actually scales with L to L cubed, which from the point of view of the gravity theory is a surface, okay, not a volume. Okay, and that's very reminiscent of the famous Wittgenstein-Hawking entropy, where the entropy is related to the area of the black hole. Okay, and so that already shows us that, so this is also, so the numbers of degrees of freedom in the bulk scale with the boundary volume, and so that's another important ingredient why ADS-CFT actually works, okay? And then finally, there's also this concept of bulk reconstruction that you can use data from the quantum field theory to obtain information about the bulk, about the gravity theory. And that's also certainly an idea that goes much beyond string theory. Okay, so that was my rather long introduction, and so the statement of my talk is going to be, let's see how far we can get if we want to establish all of these things that I showed to you in a discrete setting, okay? So the final goal is really to establish a holographic duality on a hyperbolic tiling, so which you can see here in this picture. And just a reminder, we want precisely a duality of this type, okay? And so in particular, we want both a dynamical theory in the bulk and a dynamical theory at the boundary, okay? So there are already many ideas around about bulk reconstruction, which you may be familiar with, but I don't think there's one example yet where you really have a duality where you can say, this is my Hamiltonian on the one side and this is the Hamiltonian on the other. So that's what we're aiming for. We didn't quite get there, but we made some interesting steps that I want to show to you. Okay, and so let me advertise these two papers with my collaborators, and actually, it's very nice because four of them are actually here. So Pablo Bastiero and René Meyer and Giuseppe Di Giulio and also Ratrindranath Das, who is also a PhD student working of, they're probably here in the room. I can't see very well because the light is in this direction. There you are, hi. So, they're here this week and also the next week, so they will be extremely happy to talk to you about these things if you're interested. And so please ask them questions, okay. All right, so now let me go through some details of this. All right, so the first thing I have to explain to you a little bit about this geometry of these regular hyperbolic tilings of the Poincaré disk. So if you really want to do everything properly, you should start with alias in 2 + 1 dimensions and fix a constant time slice, then you get this geometry here. So this is our constant time slice. And then you get a metric that looks like this, okay, where this is rho and phi is just the angle going around here. And then you can actually, from the metric, calculate a geodesic distance, which you see here. And okay, then here you see some examples of these regular hyperbolic tilings, and they're usually described by a pair of numbers p and q. So this symbol pq means that you have q regular polygons with p corners that meet at each vertex. Okay, here for the 7-3, so you see all these heptagons, but at every corner there's 3 heptagons that actually meet each other. And you can either draw them in this regular pattern or following geodesics. That's just a different way of doing the projection to the plane. Okay, you can also say, for the time being, let me not worry about time, and I will just restrict my attention to this Euclidean two-dimensional space that we have here. And so you can define a lot of quantities like the edge lengths, here this R or the height. And these will all depend, of course, on P and Q. The most important thing is that you want negative curvature, and you can actually show that the curvature is negative if this relation is satisfied. Now, you don't want flat space, you don't want a positively curved space, but if this relation is satisfied, we are guaranteed a negatively curved space. Okay, so the first example I want to show to you where compare to something which has been known for a long time in the ADS-CFT correspondence. It's the so-called Breiten-Nonnan-Friedman bound, which was found by Breiten-Nonnan-Friedman already in the mid-80s in the context of supergravity, so it actually predates the ADS-CFT correspondence. So, and what they found by looking at negatively curved solutions of supergravity, that actually you can associate a zero-point energy to the curvature, and that implies that, so normally, if you want to have a stable particle, it should be in a potential which is curved upwards. So if I draw a potential in field space, it should look like this, and then I can have stable fluctuations about the minimum. And then this happens if the mass squared of the scalar field is positive. If the mass squared of this scalar field is negative, then I have a runaway potential. Okay, and so if I kick the particle from its equilibrium value, it disappears off to infinity. However, if you are now in anti-de Sitter space, there's an extra energy which is, comes from the curvature of the space, and that actually shifts this. So you can imagine that your quantum field is in some sense in a box. And so this means that if we now look at this two-dimensional case that I'm considering here, so L again being the radius, the hyperbolic radius of the space, then if the mass of this mass squared of this scalar field times this length, which is a dimensionless quantity, is bigger than minus a quarter, then still your field is going to have this positive energy. So here you see the Euclidean action for this field, and then you can calculate the energy, which is this. And if you do the calculation properly in anti-de Sitter space, the mass here gets replaced by the conformal dimension squared. Okay, remember that I introduced this delta before and I said this was very important, and now that's where it shows up, so it's here. And then, so you see if this delta is positive, then the energy is also going to be positive. And so because of this relation that I showed you before between the mass and the conformal dimension, the fact that delta should be positive translates into this relation here. Okay, so even if the mass of this particle is slightly negative, you can still have a stable theory. And okay, so now we wanted to implement this on this tiling, which always means that you want to do numerics. Okay, and so what we did first is to analytically solve the equation of motion for this field in the presence of a relatively big cutoff at the boundary. So epsilon is a cutoff. So you see, because you know the space is non-compact, so there will be infinitely many of these polygons before you reach the boundary. And then, of course, you need to cut off somewhere to make some numerical calculation. Okay, and then so this is even just an analytical calculation. So if your cutoff relatively big, 0.01. So this black line, so in this plot, I have a fluctuation of the field in the center. And here I plot m squared, l squared. This l squared and that l squared are the same. I'm sorry for the double notation there. And then you see, so this black line, dashed line, is exactly where this bound is. And you see if you put this cutoff in, then when you solve this, so there's there's a Dirichlet boundary condition at the boundary, and there's a Neumann condition in the interior of the space. And then you see that there are some divergences that happen here, but they are at finite locations. And then you see that if you make your cutoff smaller, then these singularities, they start to become denser, and they also move closer to this value here. Okay, so here we can't, in the setting we have done, we can't do the numerics properly, but in the end, if you go to the continuum case, it means everything down here should be unstable. And so that's just still the continuum case, but now what happens if we solve the equation of motion numerically on the lattice? So then we have to discretize our Laplace operator here. And so astonishingly, we discover that for any tiling that you get, so any P and Q, they almost all lie exactly on top of each other. So here you see this, here is this epsilon. So if epsilon goes to zero, it means you go really far to the boundary. And there in this limit, you would actually hit this bound. And so these are the numerical computations on these various lattices, and everything seems to lie on one curve. And that's very interesting, and we are not quite sure why this happens, but I think one reason is that if you are just looking at a two-dimensional hyperbolic plane, then you can actually show there's a mathematical theorem that tells you that there's just a circle here at the boundary. And then this means that essentially the boundary behavior, which we had before, essentially controls everything. If you go to higher dimensions and you take the limit of going to infinity, then the boundary surface is going to be some complicated fractal. It's going to be a fractal and here not a nice circle anymore. And then things become probably a lot more complicated. Now, what we also did was a different calculation. So by inspired by some development in condensed matter physics, where people consider analogs of condensed matter Hamiltonians by realizing them in an electric circuit, We also consider the case where you have capacitors and inductances on your lattice. And then you can just use the Kirchhoff rules for the system, so your voltages, inductance, and capacity. And then you can also relate your mass to the inductance and capacity with some particular weight factor, which comes from the discretization. And then, in fact, what you see is that these singularities correspond to places where there's a resonance phenomenon in your spectra. So if you hit a singularity, then you get such a behavior, and if you don't, it dies off, the response dies off. So I think that's a fun fact for people who work in gravity, that you can realize your gravitational model also with inductances and capacitors. But so this is a very important branch of research in condensed matter physics to look at these systems to infer properties of real systems. Okay, so that was our first approach to see, Well, okay, so you can just realize essentially your Laplacian operator, okay? So, okay, we have to introduce a time here to make this work. So we just look at fluctuations, which are e to the e I omega t. And then for your Laplace operator, you get an equation like this. And since you know these equations, just plugging everything into your equation of motion and realizes the scalar equation. Yeah. Okay, so that's a first step towards understanding what these lattices do. But now let's move forwards in our program of actually obtaining a Hamiltonian at the boundary, okay? And so here we proceed along a way which was actually suggested by our colloquium's organizer today and with his collaborator, so that's very nice to meet now and here. And so what we actually consider in following this idea is to look at so-called inflation rules, okay? So this is a different way of constructing your lattice. The same, so I'm talking about the same lattice, type of lattices as before, but I'm using now a different way of constructing this lattice. And essentially what you do is you start with some central tile, okay? So he has two different examples with 6 and 4 corners. And then these inflation rules, so they allow you, they give you a recipe how to construct concentric layers of these tiles around the central one. And so this you do n times, little n, and little n should be very large, okay? So, and actually then you realize that there's two different types of vertices. There's those vertices which in the same or one inner layer have two neighbors, and then the blue points, in this case, they have, three neighbors. They have two in the same plane and one in the inner one, okay? So, and so there are two types of distinct vertices, and so they're denoted by red and blue dots here. And so now this inflation rule is that at every step, you replace each vertex by a sequence of vertices which appear in the next line, and then you get these very long words with the different types A and B, okay? Okay, and then this implies that if you do this n times, you get very, very long sequences of A's and B's, so then you're somewhere out here. And the boundary tiling after a large number of inflation steps is characterized by a long so-called aperiodic sequence. And and that grows by a certain factor at each step. So now this is something which is very well known in systems studied in statistical mechanics. And so now we can make use of some results for these aperiodic, from Hamiltonians with these aperiodic chains in this context here. Okay, so what we are after is to, so this is the original ADS-CFT correspondence that I just described to you in this number of dimension that we have here. And now what we would like to have, but there's, okay, there's a big red question mark there yet, so I'm not entirely sure so how many steps are still needed, but that this is our program. So that we find some kind of gravity theory on the discrete geometry of this tiling, and which then should be, so that's what we have to prove, dynamically dual to a quantum spin chain at the boundary of this tiling, okay? And so far we're just looking at the ground state, so we are interested in the ground state of the Hamiltonian describing the spin chain on the one hand side, and on the other side, we expect this to correspond to a solution of the gravity equations, which is just the tiling of the disk without any extra matter fields. Now, today, I can mostly tell you about this and some steps where we go in this direction, but what still really needs to be done is to start from scratch and build a theory here on this side. And okay, actually, while I was here, so I'm visiting here for 4 weeks, and I already talked to some people working here, in particular Bianca Dietrich, and so on. There's actually some ideas that we can use from these discretized approaches to gravity for constructing the theory on this side. So that's what I'm not going to talk about this today, but I can tell you a bit about this side of the duality. Keeping in mind all the things I said before, like the symmetries and so on. So the key message is that we're going to use this aperiodic sequence, which we get from the bulk lattice construction, as a guiding principle for constructing a Hamiltonian for the boundary theory. Okay? So if you do this inflation rule n times, then you get a boundary that looks like this with different types of vertices. And so now what we do is to use this construction principle, which is partially guided by the fact that we do something simple such that we can use existing results in the literature, okay? So each edge we associate with a spin a half particle, and this already is in conflict with what I said before, because I said we want a large n scenario, so which means we should really take a spin with in some representation of SUN, okay, but okay, we start with a simple step first, okay, we do something simple at the beginning, and once we understand this, then the next step will be to do this large n limit. So that's actually something we're working on right now while being here at Perimeter. So the simplest thing you can do is to just look at a spin a half particle, knowing that you're not going to get a gravity dual in this way because there's no large n limit. Okay. Then every vertex is associated to a bond, and now the interesting point is that we have these different types of letters, A and B, corresponding to these two different types of vertices. And then, in fact, we will get a chain like this. Okay, so here are spin a half particles, and then we have different types of couplings which form precisely this aperiodic sequence, and thus leading to an aperiodic spin chain. Now, fortunately, these have been studied in the literature already quite a bit, so I can make use of this. So then you can actually ask whether this aperiodic modulation has some effect of compared to the case where all the couplings are the same. And so there's a relevant margin, irrelevant scenario, which depends, if the system is driven to some new state given this modulation or not. So if it's irrelevant, then this modulation doesn't change the critical properties. If it's marginal, the critical properties depend on the values of the two couplings, and if it's relevant, then the system will be driven to an aperiodicity-induced fixed point. Okay, so as our model, we first take the so-called aperiodic XXZ chain, which you can see here, and again, something we choose here is nearest neighbor interactions to make our life simple, but this is another thing which you might think about in view of duality, that maybe you have to change this and also consider more long-range things. And so we allow a different type of coupling called delta zero. So here Ji are our two couplings, A and B. And so each of these Js, I is labels the sides in the lattice, but each of the couplings is either Ja or Jb. And then so for the X and Y spins, we have the standard Hamiltonian, and then we allow for an extra coupling here, which may induce an asymmetry. And okay, so then the physical parameters that we have is this asymmetry parameter, and the other important quantity is called little r, which is the ratio of the two couplings. So that's an interacting model, and you can show that it's gapless if delta is in this range. Okay, so now what we actually managed to do, our postdoc and student managed to do, was to obtain a result for the ground state of this model by using the so-called strong disorder renormalization group. So that's an approach that was designed for a disorder, but we can also apply it in this context here. And so, so there's a long text here, but essentially you can just see what's happening by looking at these fingers. And so this is for an even odd number of spins. So, you know, one of the two A or B interactions will be less frequent than the other. So you always consider a set of, say, A letters between two B couplings. And then the RG step is then to replace this geometry by the new effective coupling and this order, asymmetry parameter, and have new spins here at the boundary. And this you can do if this ratio of the cup in particular cases, if the coupling at the in the middle is much larger than the one at the boundary, then you can actually do this, okay? And so then we get a very interesting RG flow diagram. So this asymmetry parameter, because there's two couplings after some RG steps, there will be two different values for this. And so here we plot these two different values for this asymmetry parameter, and this is the ratio between the A and B couplings. And then actually, most of the models are actually going to flow to this axis where delta A and delta B vanish. So then you have an aperiodic XX model. Only the ones which are actually on this red line, okay, where these are both equal to one, they will flow to a strong disorder fixed point, and they will run to an XXX model where the couplings are all the same. And so that's a very interesting, very symmetric state, and most of the things I'm going to show now, they will relate to this particular fixed point. Okay, and now to get some feeling what we learned from this model, we actually calculated the entanglement entropy in this aperiodic XXX chain, so for this particular RG fixed point. And so in this case, the critical properties do not depend on the ratio between the couplings. And so, omitting all the details, what we get, so there's the standard thing that you have an entangling region and you look at the entanglement with the complement. So the result will be that you get these piecewise linear behavior, but there's an envelope which is actually a logarithm. So, and that's what you would expect from quantum field theory or CFT entanglement entropies, and also happens in ADS CFT. And so then you can define an effective central charge as the coefficient that you get in front of this logarithm here. And so in some cases, we're actually able to calculate this explicitly. For instance, if P is equal to 6, and then this is the result we get for this effective central charge. So of course, it's clear that it's not clear if this is any central charge of any Virasoro algebra, because of course the Virasoro symmetry is broken to some discrete subgroup. Okay, and so not, one nice thing is that we can reproduce this result in a so-called tensor network approach. So tensor networks provide a natural construction for this holographic dimension. So they have been around now in ADS-CFT for quite some time already, and are related to these holographic quantum error correcting codes. So just to give you an example what a tensor network does, we look precisely at our example now, okay? So we use the tensor network to implement this RG transformation that I just showed to you for this aperiodic spin chain. So, and the ground state of our Hamiltonian, which is this XXX Hamiltonian now, will look like this in the appropriate Hilbert space, where, you know, we have a chain of these spins, which can either be plus or minus, and there will be n of them, say. Okay, and this gives us a tensor, and now we create networks of these tensors by contracting indices here in this tensor. And in fact, now you can implement this RG step, which I just showed you, with the use of these tensors, according to the rule which is given here. But okay, let me just explain this equation by looking at this transparency. So again, we have two, say, two A coupling and one B coupling. And then with the help of these tensors, we can implement precisely the RG step we were doing before by putting one tensor here and contracting legs in this way. And here the ones at the boundary, they will be from this T1, which is essentially just leaves the vertex invariant and carries it to the next line. But you see here the thinning of degrees of freedom because some degrees of freedom get joined in this tensor here. So the upshot is we can just implement this RG technique precisely in this tensor network. And then by applying this many times, we get some beautiful pictures which in some sense reconstruct our lattice before. So by just replacing so the blocks after the RG transformation with tensor states for the entire flow and contracting the shared legs of the tensors, we obtain the tensor network which reproduces exactly the ground state of this aperiodic XX chain. So both the XXZ and XXX for the special fixed point. Okay, so essentially you see our grid which we had before, and now the green lines are precisely this tensor network. And so it's just an alternative way of implementing this RG steps, but which relate to these tensor network approaches that have already been used for reconstructing the higher dimensional space. Okay, so because the tensor network very beautifully gives you an extra dimension, and that's also happening here. Okay, and so there's an alternative way of calculating this central charge of the entanglement entropy from the tensor networks. And so these provide an upper bound, and precisely in this case when p is equal to 6, it saturates and we get a similar result than before. Okay, so this is a first step for this bulk reconstruction where we get our original space from the Hamiltonian at the boundary. The new thing being that we really have a dynamical Hamiltonian, and this tensor network is not something just put by hand, but it really represents the ground state of this Hamiltonian. So this is really the new thing in this work. Okay. So that was important. Okay, and now we can go one step further and compare with the Ryo Takayanagi formula on the gravity side. And so there we do something extremely simple, which is, okay, you know, if consider a line which goes across your anti-de-Sitter space, in continuum case, that would be this blue line. And now because we have this tiling, so it's here is shown for different examples of corners, instead of this blue line, now we have to walk along these edges. Okay, and then we can do something extremely naive, which is we assume the validity of the Ryo Takayanagi formula, but replace the length of the geodesic by this new path along this red line, which is shown there. And this was a topic of a bachelor thesis in our department by Jonathan Karl. And so he actually calculated this and then finds again. So there's again a scaling with the logarithm of the length. But so there's again an effective central charge here. And that also, of course, now will depend on P and Q through the discretization. Now, of course, we know already from the outset that this coefficient can never match what we were doing for this Hamiltonian, okay? Because, our Hamiltonian had spin a half. We are not so far that we really have established a duality. So, but here we have devised a check. So if we manage to establish this duality, then this effective coupling central charge that we should have here from the bulk should match the one which we obtained from our new Hamiltonian at the boundary. Okay. So but there, it's clear that it's not. I mean, here we have a dependence on P and Q, but it looks completely different, and that's to be expected because we did some extremely naive assumptions which we know are incompatible with holography so far. Okay, but you always have to start with something simple at the beginning and then see how far you get. Okay, in view of time, let me just not go through the summary again. I might, if there's some questions, so this is my summary slide of what I was explaining during the last 20 minutes. But I think in view of the time, let me just skip very quickly to this very interesting connection to the neighboring research areas, which I really want to show to you. So there's relations to mathematical physics, condensed matter physics, and in particular, electric circuits, quantum gravity beyond 1 over n, so for looking at going beyond this large n limit in the ADS-CFT correspondence. And there's also some work in lattice gauge theory, actually, about these lattices. Okay, so very quickly about the more mathematical things. So there's a whole entire area in mathematics that studies the boundaries of hyperbolic tiling. And so these are known as Gromov boundaries. And so so I just quoted from Wikipedia here. So the Gromov boundary of a so-called delta hyperbolic space, so it's a particular generalization of the hyperbolic spaces I've been talking about, and particular hyperbolic group, is an abstract concept generalizing the boundary sphere of hyperbolic space. And so conceptually, the Gromov boundary is the set of all points at infinity, or equivalently the end points of all the geodesics if you're in the plane. And as I said, in the two-dimensional plane, this limit circle is a limit manifold is just an S1 circle. Okay, but it's already known that in higher dimensions, these Gromov boundaries will be fractals. And okay, I don't want to go into details. They are related to these so-called Menger sponges or Sierpinski triangles. Okay, just some particular type of fractal, and it's known that the boundaries will be in this class. But I mean, here there's very little known in ADS-CFT, so if you go to one dimension higher, then you have to construct a CFT on a fractal, which is a very interesting question, but that's probably very hard to do. I advertised this very nice paper in this context where a systematic construction of perfect tensor networks and RT formulae was performed using these generalized hyperbolic spaces. So that's mathematical physics. And so the next big topic of research is to look at these hyperbolic lattices in condensed matter physics. And so there the approach is a little different from what I showed you before, but of course there are clear relations. And so the idea is to start with a tight binding Hamiltonian with nearest neighbor hopping on the lattice itself. Okay, so there is really the bulk that is of interest, not so much the boundary. And so here you see this tight binding Hamiltonian with the hopping parameter. And here you see a little excerpt of people, and I mean, really many people working and with some very important results. I just mentioned my colleague Ronny Tomala, who's also in Würzburg. And so the idea here is now to solve the Schrödinger equation, obtain the energy spectrum, and then develop a full band theory. I think that was initiated in this paper by Masheko and Hani Rayan. And so that requires to look at Fourier transforms on hyperbolic space and to generalize the Bloch theorem in this context. And so to obtain this band structure, it's essential to look at representations of the so-called Fuchsian group. So the Fuchsian group is the remainder of the conformal groups if you just look at the lattice instead of the continuum. And of course, these representations, they could also be very useful for us for establishing the duality, because I told you that symmetries are so important. However, these representations are not so... there are many papers about them in the maths literature, but it's not so easy to translate this into a physics language because they're discrete, but they're infinite and it's non-abelian. So that's three complicated things for representation theory. But I think that would be a very interesting further step to make use of the known results in the maths literature to describe the representations of fields. Okay, so then in condensed matter physics, there's not a material, at least I'm not so, I don't think, I mean, it's not so easy to have a material which has this hyperbolic structure. But what is very promising is to do this, realize these materials as a kind of meta material in electric circuits. And again, there's a huge literature on this, I think starting with this paper. Also in Würzburg, there are many people involved in this. And so just quoting some papers recently. And So one idea is to get a hyperbolic lattice from waveguide resonators. I think that was also mentioned here. And then, in particular, again, have these electric circuit networks of capacitors and inductances that I already mentioned before. And so this is inspired by the so-called topoelectric circuits, where this is used to describe topological insulators, for instance. And so here what people study is the eigenvalues of the Laplacian. So that's a bit different from our Breiten-Lohner-Friedmann idea, where we look at this energy from the action functional. And they also can show that by looking at localized excitations that there's signal propagation along the geodesics in these lattices. Okay, so, and finally, let me mention that within lattice gauge theory, there's also, so I'm aware of two groups that look at these hyperbolic lattices. And so in particular, there were studies of scalar fields, but also in Ising models that are defined on this hyperbolic lattice. And here, mostly what was done so far was to calculate the correlation functions at the boundary. And so there's agreement of the bulk results with the CFT expectations. And again, the scaling dimension does not depend on P and Q. And so again, probably this S1 at the boundary plays an important role in guaranteeing this independence of P and Q here. Okay, and as I mentioned, one important step for the future where this can, all of this can be useful is to take ADS-CFT and go beyond this limit where n goes to infinity. Okay, so where I said it's very difficult to do this within string theory, but so I'm quoting some work of Bianca Dietrich, and which I think is based on previous work by Laurent Friedel, so it's perimeter ideas here. And so where there's some discrete approaches to quantum gravity, and I think what would be useful, I mean, both for establishing the duality, but also for going beyond 1/n corrections in quantum gravity, as inspired by this string model I showed at the beginning, which could be interesting to make some progress to learn more about the ADS-CFT correspondence itself. Okay, so let me conclude. So we are looking at this discrete holography as a new example of holographic duality. And I showed it's of relevance in quantum gravity, and there's very interesting relations to condensed matter physics and also mathematical physics. So the new thing that we get is this boundary spin chain Hamiltonian, which reflects the tiling structure through the inflation rule. And so we performed an RG and tensor network study of this model and found the ground state and then constructed a tensor network for this particular ground state. So that's something which is really new in this whole tensor network approach to ADS-CFT. And so we used the entanglement entropy to probe our model. And so we have this comparison with the modified RT formula. But of course, since our model so far is very crude, especially due to this spin a half degrees of freedom, we are not yet there to make it match. And so for the outlook, I think it would be interesting to have a similar Hamiltonian which is in the large n limit by taking a representation of SUN, some anti-symmetric or adjoint representation maybe. So then we can introduce these auxiliary fermions, and maybe there's a relation to SYK, and so there's many possibilities which could be interesting. And then one can also consider beyond nearest neighbor interactions to implement this long-range scenario. Then there could be some other avenue apart from this aperiodic range could be averaging and disorder in this context. Then of course we have to make sure to implement the global symmetries. I mentioned how important this is, and here of course by construction our tensor network has a DP, so it's a dihedral symmetry with index p. So we have p pizza slices if we have a p polygon in the middle. Okay. So in some sense, the symmetries are there, but I mean, there's more work has to be done there also. And then, as I said, it would be very interesting to use some quantum gravity techniques to look at the other side of the duality, which I didn't talk about yet. Okay, that was a lot of material, so I'm done, and thank you very much for your attention.
Okay, thank you very much, Johanna. Are there any We have time for a few questions. Maybe first, any questions from students?
Hey, thank you for the talk. I'm just wondering, like, so you define like the XXX, XSZ spin chains for aperiodic chains. So I'm just wondering if they're integrable as well, because for periodic ones, they are integrable, right?
Okay, I mean, we can actually solve it, but that's maybe a question I should pass on to Giuseppe because he's our spin chain expert. So are they integrable, the spin, the aperiodic spin chains? But he says no.
Yeah,
exactly. That's the point. So since translation invariance is broken, I mean, then.
Right, but you have larger, you just have larger unit cells, though, right?
I have large what?
Larger unit cells for aperiodic chains.
It's a very good question. I'm inclined to say no because they're too complicated. But okay. And translation and symmetry is broken. But I mean, I would not make a claim. You know, it's not a forever claim. Maybe by looking very carefully at them, more can be learned. But we are very happy to find the ground state of this particular Hamiltonian. This is actually some new result. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Hey. To build a holographic duality with a fully dynamical gravity in the bulk, one needs to account for topology changes in the bulk of your theory. Do you have any ideas how this might be realized in your setup?
You mean topology changes?
In the bulk. In the examples of holographic, in the examples of ADS-CFT for sort of continuous supergravity backgrounds, you have black holes and.
Okay, so you're thinking about, okay. So I think this is a very interesting question which has many, many different aspects. Just having a black hole, I think, is not so complicated. I mean, you could just imagine boundary conditions, you know, where you just put another circle in the middle and then impose some, you could, well, you know, especially in this low dimensions, where's my picture of, okay, so if I have such a picture, I mean, you know, I could well imagine putting a black hole there with some suitable boundary conditions. This is certainly a solvable problem. But I think this question about the changing topology is actually even more interesting if you consider matrix models, okay, so because you have some internal space where you have surfaces of higher genus that appear in your matrix. So there's also this new duality of ADS2 CFD 0 plus 1 dimensions, where you study matrix models on the two sides. And there's also some interior spaces which have non-trivial topologies and so on. And that's super interesting question. So to make a contact with that, okay, so but I haven't thought about it yet. But that goes far beyond just putting a black hole. I think putting a black hole just means you put some extra boundary conditions in the middle, and this I don't imagine to be so complicated. The question is just, you know, I mean, as long as we don't have a duality, I'm not so sure it really teaches you a lot about physics to put a black hole. But okay, maybe, you know, there's some new things that arise, yeah. Yeah, so the black hole, I would say, is not so complicated to do.
But I mean, the boundary theory somehow needs to already account for it needs to contain information about the possible topology changes in the bulk.
Okay, look, we do something extremely simple, okay? We have this Euclidean spin chain there, okay, which is in equilibrium. And I think for a black hole, you know, what do you do with time and so on? And so here we have this very simple equilibrium state. Okay, so I don't think, you know, the concept of a Hawking temperature in this Hamiltonian as such makes a sense. I mean, but it's a very interesting question to ask what to do to actually obtain it. Yeah, also in the boundary Hamiltonian, but it's not there yet, I would say.
Thank you.
Thanks for the question.
Yeah, thanks, Johanna, for this nice talk. For this picture where you get the boundary via these inflation rules,
yeah.
It looks like the boundary has actually extrinsic curvature and maybe even quite a large extrinsic curvature at the discrete points. And isn't it assumed in the usual ADS CFT correspondence that the boundary is smooth and kind of flatly embedded?
Okay, it's an excellent question. Let me answer the following. So in the original ADS CFT correspondence, your boundary can always be mapped to flat space by a conformal transformation. Here, it's true that after n steps, you get something irregular. But in this analysis we did so far, we just took information from the sequence of vertices to build up our Hamiltonian. Okay, so we just used, okay, so let me show the, this is the thing you're talking about. Okay, you say this might have some extrinsic curvature, which it's probably, yes, it must have, I mean, just from the picture it looks like, okay. So, because here we just say, okay, let's forget about the space-time information and just write a field theory, which is just our spin chain Hamiltonian. And the only information that we take from the bulk is this aperiodic sequence of couplings. And so, which we just assume to be along a straight line. And we just put these spin variables there. But I think your suggestion is super good. So we should see, if what would be the effect of including this. Well, maybe one question is there any transformation that maps this thing to a straight line? I mean, this is maybe something we should investigate, okay? So the upshot, the answer to the question is, so far we didn't think about this question, we just made up a model where the only thing that we used is the sequence of these labels, and we didn't use the information that this thing has a curvature. But I think, the first question to ask is, is there any transformation that maps this line to a flat line? I think maybe in ADS2 it probably does, because if you take the limit n to infinity, you would end up with a sphere. Okay, it's a mathematics question. And in higher dimensions, then you get these fractals. And especially, so here in this case, if we do an infinite number of steps, we just get a circle. So everything is smooth and flat. But if we do this in ADS3, then you will never get, say, a sphere. You just get some fractal thing, and then it becomes even more complicated.
And maybe it's another question, because you mentioned the bulk Hamiltonian, but from a gravity perspective, one would expect a Hamiltonian constraint and actually diffeomorphism constraint. So to come to describe the bulk dynamics.
Why should this be impossible?
No, I mean, do you assume a proper Hamiltonian, or is it rather constraints?
No, that's the thing. I mean,
satisfy in algebra and so on.
Well, it's a super good question. I'm going to ask you in more details, because we haven't done anything about this yet. So the question is about, let me go. Yeah, okay, so about this theory. Okay, So what we want, I can tell you what we want, okay, but I have no idea how to get there. So what we want is a true Hamiltonian that is associated to this tiling of the Poincaré disk, okay? So that's what we aim for. But at the moment, I have no idea what to do, but, I think maybe an approach would be promising, similar than we did here, just to say, okay, let's look at the literature, your papers, okay. So what is available for spin systems, say, on such a discrete tiling, and can we make any sense of this here? I mean, of course, I would do the minimal thing possible just to start with, especially I want to keep the structure of these tilings. I mean, we don't want any random fluctuations. That's going to be very, very complicated and maybe even unnecessary for a first step. We want to preserve these tilings, and okay, maybe you can make the bonds fluctuate, or you put some dynamical degrees of freedom on the vertices and make them fluctuate. So, and this should definitely give a Hamiltonian. Yeah.
Okay, I know there are a few more questions lingering, but in view of time, why don't I suggest, so there's tea and snacks in the bistro. If you, maybe we could divert additional questions to there, and let's give Johanna a final thanks for a great talk.
Thank you. you.